You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show, considered the hottest podcast in the universe by Martians. Now get ready for the heat. Here's Brian Callen.
All right, everybody, this is The Brian Callen Show. Today's show is brought to you by Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/BCS, which stands for The Brian Callen Show, which is what you're listening to, and you will get a free audio book download. I am listening right now to Republic Lost by Lawrence Lessig, brilliant Harvard lawyer, and he basically breaks down why big money in politics is ruining our republic. It's a really interesting book. And the great thing about, you know, listening to a book is I think you get more out of it typically because they hire great actors. And on top of that, you can listen or you can actually read a book when you're driving or running or doing whatever it is you're doing. So I have been using audible.com for many years. I've probably listened to close to 50 books using the service, so I can't recommend it highly enough. And by the way, if you don't listen to Lolita with Jeremy Irons, and if you don't listen to Blood Meridian with Richard Poe, you're just remiss. I mean, there's a hole in your life, and you don't know that until you actually have that experience. Go to audiblepodcast.com/BCS and enrich your mind. Expand your brain. The guy you hear laughing is Hunter Motz. Hunter, you know, we did an he wrote a book called The Straight A Conspiracy, and we did a podcast about that book. But you know, you're somebody who I love talking to because not only have you done a shitload of reading, you're so clear, and you're so well. You really encapsulate issues that I think people feel and want to know about, but don't know how to articulate. And that's always very refreshing. So, and you know, what we'll talk about today is we'll talk about broad concepts. What's wrong with this country? Why nations fail? What the challenges of the future are? And just really quickly, give us your background, because you are ridiculously smart. I mean, you have a very good brain, although I know you don't really believe that. It's just a question of the fact that you believe that learning is controlled by emotions.
Yeah, and what you believe. I mean, that's the thing. You know, 2,600 years ago, the Buddha was basically trying to figure out, you know, to what extent does our mind create our reality, right?
Yeah.
And he basically had realized what we now, 2,600 years later, have figured out scientifically, which is that what you believe affects your emotions, and then those beliefs are then reinforced by your experience, right? So if you believe you're bad at math, right, well, then you're going to have an emotional state, which is going to cause your attention to be less engaged, and so you'll learn less. Right. And so essentially your original theory seems to be true.
Yeah. And if you read Malcolm Gladwell's book, you know, he talks about the fact that math is going to be hard.
Yeah.
You don't learn the violin. And I'm sorry to even say this, but you're not going to be a good stand up. It's going to take you about 10 years because certain things, there is a technical aspect. Stand-up's probably a bad example, but it's not.
No,
actually,
it's the same thing, yeah.
But there is a technical aspect. There's a sort of how to communicate with an audience, and there's certain things muscularly you have to do on the trumpet or the
right.
violin or with math.
Right.
Your brain has to start being able to think this way, and it takes work.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a culture that kind of shies from the first,
well,
you know, I mean, not that's not fair to Americans.
It doesn't. I mean, that's the thing. In some areas, we really understand that practice. Like,
yeah.
Nobody would expect that you should step into the cage of a UFC match and, like, you know, kick ass the first time.
Right.
And then, you know, when you walk out a bloody pulp, you're like, well, I guess I'm just not a natural UFC fighter.
But people treat math that way. And
they
treat our children that
That's
way.
That's right. And they treat funny that way. Like,
yeah.
A lot of people think, oh, he's just a funny person. He's just not, and all that sort of stuff.
Right.
And it's
right.
All of these things are, you know, I mean, in the 1200s, they really had the guilds and they understood that everything was a craft.
Hmm.
And you acquire a craft. And, you know, you have to go through an apprenticeship. And at the end of the apprenticeship, you are good enough to be able to teach that craft to other people.
And ultimately create your own craft
or expand
on that craft.
That's right.
That becomes the responsibility of an adult, in my opinion.
That's right.
When you're, you know, is you learn the technique and
then
you have to go beyond the technique.
Then
you have to make the technique not only your own, but you have to come up with your own original expression,
right.
Whether it's learning how to punch somebody in a different way or mm-hmm. learning how to, you know, make them laugh in a different way. That's what I think that's what the responsibility you can never run away from. And as a human being, what's funny is that no amount of hype, no amount of, it's why I always say that there are certain things you can't fake. You can't fake fucking well. You can't fake dancing well. You can't fake fighting well. And you can't fake comedy.
Right.
You know, you're either laughing, coming,
or you're not.
Or you're getting knocked out, exactly. Or knocking someone out. I mean, these are things.
And if you're Brian Callen, you're doing all three at the
same time. Well, I just tweeted today. I mean, the great news is I'm the king, and the okay news is that I'm only the king of comedy, sex, and fighting, and dance. So I'm limited. You've said some really, the other day we were eating Thanksgiving, you kind of said some great things that had me thinking. Talk to me about the experiment they did where they said to these kids, we have a test that can measure who's going to jump in mm-hmm. intelligence. Tell that story.
There's what in education circles is called the Rosenthal effect. And basically this researcher named Rosenthal from the Harvard Graduate School of Education came along and they went to a rural school somewhere in the United States and they said to the teachers, we've got this new test. And what this test can do is it can measure when a kid is about to spurt. Right. And so the teachers are like, oh, these people are from the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Like they know what they're talking about.
Sure.
So they hand out the test. Now, unbeknownst to the teachers, this is actually just a standard, boring IQ test. It doesn't measure
anything.
Right. So the kids all take the test. And then at the end, the people from the Graduate School of Education, they pick out a random group of kids. And they're like, these six kids, these however many kids, they're about to spurt. And they tell the teachers. They say, like, kid A, kid Q, kid P, whatever. These kids are about to spurt, so watch out. Because, like, magic's going to happen this year. And so the teachers are like, oh, okay. And so they come back at the end of the year, and they re-give the IQ test. And the kids who were due for a spurt went up 28 IQ points.
28, just because they were told.
Told
that.
That's right.
It's unbelievable. And I'm sure the teacher as well probably taught them differently.
It's as simple as the fact that you're watching that kid and you're like waiting for the magic to happen. And
right.
like the kid picks up on the fact that they're getting more attention and that they're being taken more seriously and all that.
Well,
human
beings need attention for their development.
That's right.
I don't think it ever changes either. We so much of what we drives us is status and reputation and just mm-hmm. wanting to be loved. And
William James was probably the greatest American. He's in some senses the founder of psychology, in some senses the greatest American philosopher of all.
Really?
He said the deepest need in human nature is to be appreciated.
Huh.
And when I read that, I was like floored because that is so, I mean, for me at least, I think that's so true. And I think that's true for all of us.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's no question. And my friend who works with addicts, very bad addicts, mm-hmm. people who need a new liver and stuff, and he's kind of the last resort they send him to. And he said that, you know, a lot of times these people just were never looked at. Mm-hmm. They don't actually believe they have a right to exist anyway.
That's right.
It was really kind of a profound thing. Like, what would you learn? What's the thing? Mm-hmm. Well, they, you know, after all that, my feeling is they just were never really appreciated. They were
right.
never looked at by their parents, never seen,
mm-hmm.
Which seems like such a simple thing. But man, we are in so many ways. And I talked to Joe Rogan about this a lot. We're so connected, you
mm-hmm.
know.
Or disconnected, and we pay the price for that.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about our culture, our American culture as it stands? What do you think the challenges are? What do you think we've lost? What do you think we've gained? And where do you think we're going?
Well, I actually think we're at a really, like, it's darkest before the dawn. I think that we're not necessarily at the best place in our history, but I think that there are a bunch of things that are coming together that are going to take us basically to a second renaissance.
Renaissance. But he grew up overseas. I love when you say process, and you lived in England
for a long time. So yeah,
Renaissance.
Periodically, I say bean instead
yes.
of bin.
Tell us how many languages you speak.
Many.
All right.
But
keep going. So.
But so I, you know, essentially, what it really comes down to is what do we believe that a human being is capable of. Right. And we all hold different beliefs both about ourselves and about our fellow human beings. Right. But there have been these high water marks for what we believed about human beings. Like in the Renaissance, the Renaissance, whatever we want to call it, right? There was this rediscovery of what a human being could do. Like right. In the Dark Ages, you know, most people thought that people were crap.
Well, the authorities were the Bible and Aristotle.
That's right.
Right?
And everything, and how dare you think you could have an original thought, you right. know? And Martin Luther began.
Yeah, so much of that, the Dark Ages, you know, the idea was that the science and the truth has been settled.
That's right.
Right? Yeah.
And, you know, you see the same thing, for example, in the Muslim world. There was this period in the 10th or 11th century where they have the closing of the gates. Basically, after the Quran and all of the hadiths are originally written, there's this process of actively interpreting the Quran and trying to figure out what it says. Mm. And then there was this process where they closed the gates and they said, everything that can be thought and figured out about this has been figured out.
Yeah.
And you contrast that with, say, the Jewish relationship to the Torah and the Talmud, right? They are always questioning, always
it's
trying to figure out.
It's always being
that's
debated.
Right.
I mean, so many of the stories of rabbis just even seeing miracles before them going, ah, I don't buy it.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, you know, and I think that that's so important because they're treating the truth as a verb as opposed
mm-hmm.
to a noun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a very important concept. I think that the Islam, you know, the problem with any puritanical form of that religion, Wahhabi Islam, mm-hmm. You know, that you see in Saudi Arabia as opposed to the Islam that's practice for the most part in Indonesia, which is way more moderate and way
that's
more
right.
flexible, is the idea that this is the truth. And the thing that a lot of people don't realize about the Quran is that in a lot of ways it's a blueprint for how to structure society. It even goes into banking laws.
And the yeah. you know, I mean, my dad lives in Libya, mm. and you know, I mean, he thinks that, you know, the Quran does a much better job of like dealing with financial regulation than, for example, the Bible or the Talmud or the Torah, because one of the stipulations is you constantly have to reinvest your money.
Yeah.
And that's the thing is that it's not good.
But isn't there a sort of a taboo or against actually earning interest on money?
There is, and that may
that, that's
not
kind of a usury.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, you know, once you get into like a modern capitalist society, like that can be good because ultimately the bankers are able to pool that money and therefore, you know, invest in much larger projects than any individual could.
Right.
Right. But there are certainly like there are things about the Quran that are quite sophisticated that, you know, and that's simply because the Quran comes along 600 years after Christianity, after, you know, the
yeah.
New Testament.
Yeah, that's right.
So primarily, right, Muhammad was a trader. Like he was a businessman. Mm. So, you know, he had his attention much more on these things and understood financial problems in a way that
I think he also, you know, the legend goes that he brought the tribes together. They were
yeah.
constantly at war. They were nomadic sort of tribes that were fighting all the time and said, I'm going to bring them together under one book.
There's a famous Arab saying that they have, which is me against my brother and I against my cousin,
that's right.
and my brother, my cousin, and I against the stranger.
That's right.
Yeah.
Another way of saying what unifies us is fucking war.
Yeah, exactly. And that's basically what Muhammad did, is he yeah. was like, the only way to get these people to stop killing each other is mm. to get them killing someone else.
Ain't that human?
Yeah,
ain't
it
that,
is.
Ain't that human
yeah,
history?
Absolutely.
You know, you read Guns, Germs, and Steel and Hunter-Gatherer Tribes, and there's this idea that the Native Americans, I just did Meat Eater and Steve Rinella, who hosts that show, he's read more about Native American culture and history. I mean, you know, there's this idea that these people were all living a bucolic lifestyle, violent as fuck, constantly killing each other,
yeah,
constantly at war with each other. But this is human beings.
Yeah, I mean,
Europe, for God's sake, was at war for, you know, 500 years.
That's
and,
right.
And then finally culminating in World War II and World War, you know, World War I and World War II with 50, 60 million corpses lying about. I mean, you know.
Well, and the reason why the European Union was even founded was
right.
to stop France and Germany from going to war again.
Yeah.
You know?
Always rumbling. And look yeah. at it now. France
well, and
headed,
absolutely.
Yeah, France is headed for a crisis.
You heard it here first.
Well, they deserve it. Yeah. I mean, if they're gonna vote a socialist in, you know, I don't know what you people think. It's like none of these people in power in France have any fucking business sense. They don't have any business experience. They never worked in a business. Never had to make the trains run on time. They never had to run a business.
But yet
they have all these rules. It's a very business. It's not friendly to business at all.
But I think, you know, like the fact that France is gravitating much more towards socialism, you know, there are a lot of really bad ideas that are floating up right now. And that's because essentially I think we're quite lost.
Hmm.
I don't think that there's, you know, there's not.
But doesn't that, I'm sorry to interrupt, but doesn't that See, that's why when you're studying the origins and the causes of a crisis, like the financial crisis, mm-hmm. is so important. You do have to disseminate. You can't just say, well, it's greedy bankers. No, that kind of just cookie cutter notion that you hear in the media and stuff is destructive. It's actually a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of factors, and it's important to understand and continue to read about how it happened, because otherwise you're going to point to the wrong enemy.
That's right.
And then you're going to say, well, free markets are shit. Let's go to a planned economy. Well, anybody who says that should pick up a fucking history book.
Well, and you know, one of the really interesting examples in this book that you mentioned at the beginning, Why Nations Fail, right, is they talk about like China. And everybody looks at China and they say, oh, look at China's amazing economic growth. Like, they're just growing so fast and it's like so impressive, and China must have it all figured out. Well, what they don't realize is that in the 1930s and 40s, do you know which country had the fastest economic growth?
No.
The Soviet Union. And the reason why is because when you have all of these people who are all crowded into these peasant farms, and then you suddenly move them into factories, yeah, you're going to get economic growth. But it's not sustainable economic growth, because at a certain point, you're going to have moved as many people into factories as you can, and then you're going to need to start having innovation. Mm. And the real problem with innovation is that innovation leads to creative destruction. So when someone figures out a better way to make something, people lose jobs. Right. So, for example, if someone invented like a flying car or whatever, well, the big three automakers would have to adapt or die. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, people don't like that. Mm-hmm. Like, people don't like to have to change. And so typically in these totalitarian governments like China, right, what they do is that they try and keep things the same.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what the Soviet Union did. And that's what
order is very, very Confucian.
That's right.
It's very, very important to sort of. That's right. One of the things that's amazing about China is how vast a country it is, and how so many people in such a large area speak Mandarin, mm-hmm. which Jared Diamond credits the Yangtze and the Yellow River for, because you were able to cover so much ground just by boat, and so you shared ideas, you know, in such a large area.
Well, and
area.
It becomes very easy for the government to project power all the way into the interior. Mm. I mean, that's the thing. You know, if you're trying to project power, like, for example,
it's not Afghanistan, Kabul can't do much.
It's a nightmare.
Yeah.
Right. Because, yeah. You know, there are mountains, there are canyons, there are all these sorts of things.
That was a problem with Ireland, in fact.
It's the
Ireland
problem.
Was never able to really be unified and could mount any kind of a resistance to Britain, because they were essentially tribal. I mean, the topography broke them up into into counties.
That's right.
Which were tribes, which were called Tuatha's, you know. And so, you know, they were always fighting each other. I mean, there was no idea of an Ireland necessarily.
No, not at all.
So when Cromwell and they came in and did all that terrible stuff, it was hard for them to mount a resistance. I'm sorry, though, we keep going off topic. So why nations fail? Continue to you were saying that you're so optimistic because you think we're on the verge of a renaissance in this country, in the world, even though there are a lot of bad ideas floating about.
Well, and that's the thing is that essentially, you know, when you reach 1990, right, and the Soviet Union collapses. Right. There seems to be this moment where you're saying, aha, we have it figured out. Right. The answer is to have democracy and to have the free market system, to have capitalism. Right. The problem is that, you know, there are discontents within democracy and free market capitalism. Right. Like, not everybody. I mean, you look at this last election. People are like, there are things that Democrats censor wrong and there are things that Republicans censor wrong. Mm. And they can't really pinpoint what the problem is. And in the United States, we have a strong, strong commitment to both of those ideas, democracy and capitalism. So we're not willing to mess with the formula. France, on the other hand, is like, well, maybe the problem is the problem of equality, which is an old one. Mm. Right? Like, inequality is inherently uncomfortable for people. Mm. Right? In fact, when you look at those hunter-gatherer tribes, they're remarkably egalitarian.
Very much so. They could never find really a chief or anything.
No.
That's right.
They, in fact, like, there's one of the things that they tend to do is they tend to, like, when they'll go and kill a deer, the first thing they'll do is they'll drag it into the middle of the village. Mm. Right? So that everybody can see the kill, and then they will split that kill up right away. And partly that's limited by technology, because there was no way to preserve meat. Mm. And so, you know, you either throw it away or give it to someone, and then at least you're getting the loyalty from that person,
right,
and the understanding that at some point when there's meat, they'll give you meat back.
Yeah, it's so funny that that's subsistence living, and then there becomes this, you know, as societies become more complex, you do deal with what you just said is very interesting about China. And I've always said that. When was the last time you bought a Chinese computer, a Chinese car, or anything? It's all originated in this country, mm-hmm. you know. And, you know, there's, but primarily for this country, this is still far and away the hotbed of innovation.
That's right.
And it really goes back to, I think, this American idea, and a beautiful idea, that the individual can change the world.
That's right.
And that you as an individual are actually more important than anything else. That can tend to be, that has its limits too, but when it's great for innovation, it's great for new ideas. And you're right, China, but I love what you said about innovation requiring creative destruction.
Right, and that's, you know, I can't take credit for that. Like, that comes from Why Nations Fail, and then they took it from, I think, Peter Drucker before that. But yeah, I mean, that's fundamentally the challenge, is that, you know, innovation destroys what was done before. Mm. And people don't like
and so,
that.
So in a way, China, to really continue, you think, they're going to have to change essentially their national consciousness, their
Absolutely.
Culture. I don't think that's as hard as people think, because the great thing is, people say, there's a guy named Rory Parker, I think that's his last name, and he gives several TED Talks. One fantastic talk on Afghanistan and how wrong we've been for the 11 years and just how we're dealing with that war. But he walked it. And one of the things that he talks about is the importance of, when you argue for democracy and free markets, don't argue in terms of what they give you.
Mm-hmm.
Argue in terms of what they are in themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, in the remotest parts of the world, he's been in the remotest parts of Afghanistan, in the remotest parts of different places in the world, he said, I've never met anyone who didn't want a say in who rules them.
Yep.
I've never met anybody who didn't want a say in who rules them. And that is what democracy at its heart is about. And you hear people all the time saying, well, they don't have a tradition of democracy. They don't like democracy. The Arabs don't want democracy, or for example. No, yeah. they're used to a strongman. The only way to keep those groups together is with a strong arm. It is the most ridiculous argument. All human beings
want
all
to be
of them,
appreciated.
They want to be appreciated, and they want a say in who rules them.
Mm-hmm.
They want a better life for their children. They want a say in that,
mm-hmm.
et cetera, et cetera. So I always say that. I always, you know, and that he put it very, very well. It's a TED Talk. I think it's Rory Parker. Forgive me if I'm getting the name wrong, but I recommend going to TED.com anyway, because they got the leaders of thought and everything, you know, from social science to, you know, everything, even math, giving lectures. So continue on sort of where you think we're going. You think we're on the verge of a renaissance. Explain that.
Well, so in this book, Why Nations Fail, they say that the key to, like, the best way to have an effective society is political and economic inclusivity, right? So a system in which everybody has a say in politics and everybody is able to participate in the economy. Right? Which, that's not true, for example, in China. There are limits to who really gets access to those economic opportunities, right?
You were giving an example of Mexico, the richest man in the
right.
world.
Right. So Carlos Slim, who is the richest man in the world, right? They talk about this in this book, Why Nations Fail. And basically, you know, he bid on Telmex, which is the Mexican telecoms company, their phone company. And that's where his fortune is based off of. But he didn't even submit the highest bid. Right. So he won the bidding without submitting the highest bid. And that's essentially because he had connections in the government. And so they gave it to him. Mm. Now, every single time that Carlos Slim has tried to come and do business in the United States, he's failed.
Mm.
And the reason why is because fundamentally he can't compete in a free and open market. Right. He's using his political connections to get ahead financially.
So he's good at being corrupt. He's
that's
not
right.
good at creating a product. Or a good that people are willing to buy over the competition.
And it speaks on its own, right.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing, is that if you really want a great society, the most innovative society possible, everybody has to have a fair chance to compete. But the question that, you know, is asked in Why Nations Fail is there anything after political and economic inclusivity? Right, it's the same question that Francis Fukuyama, who wrote this book, The End of History and the Last Man, he said, is there anything after capitalism and democracy?
Mm.
And they're not very clear on what it is, but because of what I've spent the last 8 years thinking about, I think there is. And I think the goal, and I don't think it's something that has to be legislated, but I think it's something that a culture should strive towards, is intellectual inclusivity.
Wow. That's interesting.
Yeah, because essentially, you know, and that's why, I mean,
But you know, I have to say that when you talk about democracy and free markets, what mm-hmm. I think about
mm-hmm.
is actually ultimately those are byproducts of a philosophical understanding that personal liberty is paramount.
Mm-hmm.
And that strikes me as being, I don't know if there's anywhere to go from there, but that's not my job.
But the thing is that, yeah, personal liberty is paramount. But if you remember from the last time we talked, and we've talked about this since then, but, you know, essentially, you know, when you're a kid in school and you don't think that you're capable of being good at math, you are restricted.
I see. That's interesting.
Right? That's not real liberty.
Oh, that's interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
And in the same way, if, for example, you also talked about, I don't really think of myself as a business person, right? You're restricted because essentially that idea is cutting you off from being able to participate in the market.
Yeah.
And that's why it shouldn't be legislated, because, like, it's ultimately your idea, but it's in your interest to get rid of that idea. And it's also in society's interest to help you get rid of that idea. Because the point is that, you know, if, you know, you think that you can really be a great businessman and you think you can do math and you think you can be funny and you think you can do all these things, I mean, then we all win.
Right.
And you know, and that's that applies across fields. Like, I think one of the best examples is, you know, John Adams and Benjamin Franklin both went to France in order to try and get France into the American Revolution.
Right.
Right?
Right. Because they wanted help against the British.
They wanted help against the British, and the fundamental problem that the United States had is that we didn't have a decent navy. Right. Mm-hmm. We basically had one ship, and the British had the best navy in the world.
Right.
And so they were basically like, come on, France, you hate Britain. This is your chance to like have a proxy war with Britain. Right. And so what happened is that the Benjamin Franklin was a huge success. They loved him because he spoke French and he spoke Italian and he was charming and he was funny and he flirted with the ladies and he understood politics and he understood fine wine. I mean, he had this like broad, broad knowledge and he was just like awesome. He was a stand-up comedian plus like, you know, a ladies man and all that stuff.
I didn't know that about Franklin.
John Adams was the most boring, puritanical person in the world.
Jesus.
And like the French couldn't handle him. Like he was just like the death of every party.
Really?
Yeah. And so essentially, that's the thing is that it's not, it's, you know, yeah, John Adams was an amazing lawyer and he was very smart and he made huge contributions.
Right.
But we're better off having a figure like Benjamin Franklin who
Forgive
can do
my,
all
well, I think
of those
John
things.
Adams was the second, became the
second
president,
president
of
the
United
States.
States.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And wrote what did he wrote several
he wrote the Constitution of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts
that's right. These are things that are so important, man. I mean, talk about heroes.
Yeah.
I mean, Jesus. All right, so keep going. I'm sorry. So
that's the point is that ultimately what we want as a society is intellectual inclusivity, right? Where we all think that we are capable of accessing all ideas. And the problem is that, you know, on the simplest level in school, we think there are math people and we think there are arts and English people.
Mm.
Well, what's the result of that belief? Well, we have these amazing mathematicians and scientists who can't communicate. And so therefore aren't able to like explain like here's why we think global warming is an issue.
Mm.
Here's why we think this, you know, we should be allowed to do stem cell research. Here's why we need more funding to be able to do this. Here's why the Large Hadron Collider is important, right? And so essentially like science is not able to fulfill its potential.
You're a biochemistry major
from
Harvard. What why didn't you go to get your PhD and why didn't you become a scientist? And then I want to ask you why the Hadron Collider is important. You may not know. But, yeah.
Well, actually, there's a pretty good book that came out recently, actually written by my old physics professor.
Oh, really?
Yeah, called Knocking on Heaven's Door.
I've heard about
that. Yeah, that sets out to answer exactly that question.
Gee
why
whiz,
do we
man.
Need,
yeah.
Why do we need the Large Hadron Collider?
Let's talk about that.
So, firstly, why didn't I get my PhD and go into biochemistry research? And the answer actually comes because after I finished high school, I went and worked for a year at Cold Spring Harbor, which is this big biomedical lab on Long Island, and actually spent a year living, not only working at the lab, but also living in the house of James Watson.
No
of
shit.
Watson and Crick,
sure.
Who discovered the double
a
helix.
A little something called the double helix,
yeah.
which was I guess, DNA, right?
Yeah. I mean, they figured out the structure of DNA.
It was the great leap forward in science.
Yeah.
And now we have the genome, the Human
That's
Genome
right.
Project, but yeah.
And so I lived in his house for a year, and
died, right?
No,
it,
well,
was it Crick or was it Watts?
Crick died. Not,
yeah. Is Watts still alive?
The last I heard.
Jeez.
I mean, you never know what happens
like
in the middle of a podcast.
What a genius. Yeah, exactly.
But what I realized from working at that lab for a year is that like the environment was incredibly hostile. Like it was just not a friendly environment. And also just that there was a huge disconnect between what scientists knew and what the public knew. And that, you know, I think part of the reason why a lot of people resent you know, the money that is being spent on this research that doesn't seem to lead anywhere is because A, they're not seeing where it leads, because it does lead to places, and B, because scientists are such terrible communicators as a role.
Yeah, they really are.
And so, you know, it's not, yeah, I mean, you know, and Lisa Randall, who wrote Knocking on Heaven's Door, she attempts to, like, deal with some of this. You may not have known this, but...
God, I thought I was a man, and your teacher, physics teacher, was a woman.
There you go.
Boy, do I have,
But see, and that's the thing.
I was just picturing an old crutchety gray guy who's a physics teacher. I write books called Knocking on His... on the physics door. That's my physics teacher
voice.
Impersonation.
Yeah, it's good.
I'm really good with characters. Really good with characters. So what is, why the Hadron Collider? Explain what it is, and then...
Well, the Large Hadron Collider is basically a particle accelerator, and what you do is you take, you know, very, very small subatomic particles, and you smash them together at really, really high speed, and then based on the pieces that come out of that collision, you can figure out how does matter actually work. Right? What is matter made of?
That's fucking crazy. What the fuck is what I had to say?
Yeah.
How do you even start thinking about that? I don't even know how to start thinking about stuff like that. I don't even know what the fuck you're talking about. Matter and smashing shit together. I mean, it's just like, who are the people that actually make the, I don't even know what to talk about. What do you mean? We're gonna make a. What is it? Fucking. I don't. What we're gonna. We need some metal alloy. We're gonna smash particles together. Who does it? Who welds it? Who makes it? Who designs that shit?
Well,
that's smart. That's ridiculous brain power. Fuck! I'm just thinking about getting laid and eating out. I'm a fucking idiot, man.
Well, no, but that's the thing is that, you know, it's like, how does Bruce Lee do what he does?
I'm yawning. I'm tired. I'm fucking exhausted at the thought. I try to think that much about it, and I'm fucking losing my energy. Go on. What?
But so the point is that they smash all this shit together, right? And
yeah.
In the process, they figure out more about how matter works. And one of the examples that she gives is that the theory of relativity is actually a big part of how GPS works. Right?
Okay.
So, you know, people think, like, the theory of relativity, this weird thing that Einstein did, why would anybody actually use it? Except we all use it every day.
Wow.
And when you're...
Why? How?
Well, because essentially the way GPS works is you have multiple satellites and they all send signals down.
Yeah.
Right? But the problem is that when you're going over that distance and that time and all that stuff, you have to adjust for, like, the minor shifts that happen because of the theory of relativity.
Good God. Oh, because they're so far out.
They're so far out and they're moving so fast so that stuff starts to become significant.
So they're, in some ways, they're bending time a little bit.
Yeah, a little bit.
What the fuck?
But the thing is that, you know, that's the sort of thing where, yeah, the theory of relativity.
So then their theory of relativity is not a theory. The theory of relativity is real.
Well, but see, here you get into, like, here's the difference between science and, for example, religion.
Yeah.
Which is that religion is based on faith and science is based on doubt.
Yeah.
Yes. Right. And so, you know, what has happened is, you know, Newton says, I have a theory of gravity.
Yeah.
Right. And we still call it the theory of gravity because it's an idea of, like, how does gravity work? And it turns out that his theory actually explains a lot of things, but it doesn't explain everything. So, for example, when you start to get near the speed of light, right, his theory doesn't work anymore. And then Einstein comes along and he says, well, I have a theory about how gravity works near the speed of light.
Right.
And
I was going to say there's the quantum theory. There's quantum
right.
theory. And then there's the theory that we the sort of the ether that we, you know,
that's
as,
right.
as Newton called it. So that there's Newtonian physics and quantum physics. I mean, Newton was dealing with what he could see and measure.
That's right.
And then you get into quantum physics, which is the subatomic world
right.
that in some ways, I guess, Newton's theories actually sometimes can be literally reversed.
Yeah, they don't. It doesn't.
Reality
is
a completely different fucking thing.
That's right. And what's honest about science is that it realizes that essentially we deal in models of the world.
Yeah.
Right? Like the point is
like
that,
like Plato's theory of forms.
That's right. Or if you're talking about,
you can,
like,
imagine something. It doesn't mean you can touch it.
Right. Or, you know, you think about how the models that different people in the United States have of the Arab world.
Yeah.
Right? There are some people who think there are a bunch of savages running around with Kalashnikovs all the time.
Yeah.
There are some people who think, oh, they've been treated so badly by the West and blah, 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 blah. And, like, those are two theories. And do they actually explain what happened? No. A more accurate theory is that they are people like us. They just have a different history and
that's
all
right.
of that sort of
that's
stuff.
Right. Reacting the way all of us would probably react.
Yeah.
That's right.
But that's the point, is that the reason why everything in science remains a theory is because, you know, it's not going to explain everything. And ultimately, you know, if the cool thing about science is that a single result can destroy everything we know.
A single result can destroy everything we know. That's right. That's right.
And that's not true with religion.
And science is always, that's right. Science is always ready to, or has to be always ready to be sort of, I mean, that's the thing about being a scientist. You can spend your entire life and win a Nobel Prize, you know, for proving a theory. And somebody comes along and goes, thanks for the work, dude. Your life is a waste because the truth is over here.
Yeah.
There's the aquatic ape theory, and there's all those kinds of things that
There's all sorts of whacked out stuff that's floating out there. But essentially, it's what science really is. It's a method for determining truth, or at least closer and closer approximation to the truth.
What do you think of evolution? The idea that we did branch from monkeys. I mean, there's a lot of evidence, obviously, but the thing that I always get hung up on, and I'm not a creationist, my God, but evolution has big holes in it. In that it seems to me. It's very hard for me to wrap my head around the fundamental difference between human beings and animals is that human beings have potential, and they can become almost anything they want to be. What we are creating. I mean, if you look at where technology is going, it's magic.
Well, see, but here's the thing, right? So for a long time, we've tried to figure out what makes us special, right? And
yeah.
Like people talk about the opposable thumbs. Thumbs can move that can move in all different directions, and that makes tool making possible.
Yeah, that stuff, yeah.
Right, and you know, and like the ability to imagine and all these sorts of things. Well, firstly, take a look at the brain. There was a guy named McLean in the 60s who talked about the triune brain hypothesis. And he basically said, this is the way that I'm going to view the brain, right? And that there are three layers. And the innermost layer is the reptilian layer.
Right.
And essentially, like that part of the brain, there are a lot of similarities with how reptiles behave. That's the part of the brain that is in control of breathing, thirst, just really basic stuff.
Yeah, autonomic,
right?
You know.
Right.
Yeah.
Then there's the paleomammalian, which is the old mammal part of the brain on top of that. And we share a lot of that in common with, you know, dogs, cats, you know, monkeys, all of that sort of stuff, which is why you can tell how your dog's feeling. Because literally the emotional systems and the expressions are so similar that you can pick up their emotional responses.
Yeah.
So the difference is it's not that like humanity is this massive leap. It's just that on top there's this extra layer, which is the neomammalian cortex. And as we start to look more closely at, you know, that's why a lot of work that's done in chimps, right, and a lot of work that's done in bonobos, which are like really
bonobos,
small chips.
Yeah, bonobos are, yeah, they're smarter than.
Yeah.
They really have, I mean, there's a couple of documentaries on. They are, you can teach a bonobo how to start a fucking fire.
Yeah, I mean, they can do amazing stuff.
Yeah.
And they make tools, they do what's called termite fishing.
That's right.
Where they take a stick, a really thin stick, they'll stick it into a termite mound, it'll get covered in termites, and then they'll pull it out and they'll eat the termites. And, you know, my girlfriend in college was an anthropologist, and so she was really into this stuff. And there's a famous story about these Japanese macaques, right? These monkeys in Japan,
yeah.
Right? And they're these snow monkeys. And essentially, they had these sweet potatoes. And what they would do is that one of the two troops, one of the groups of monkeys, would take their sweet potatoes, and before they would eat them, they would wash them off in the river. Right, they would clean it so they didn't have to eat the dirt.
Wow.
And the amazing thing was that another troop, right, saw them doing this and copied the technology. So, you know, a lot of the precursors of, you know, innovation and tools and technology, they are already there. All that stuff, it's already there. It's just that obviously it's been refined to another level. And of course, you know, Newton always said that if I have seen further, it's because I have stood on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah.
So,
but this is, there's no question. I mean, that's why the Aborigines of Australia were in the Stone Age when, you know, white settlers and white convicts came because they didn't have the benefit of sharing any of the information
from
so many. And the same thing with the Peloponnesian Islands and stuff. That's, there's no question.
And you look at, for example, firearms, right?
Yeah.
That is a great example because, you know, the Chinese come up with gunpowder.
That's right.
It gets passed along. The Turks basically develop the cannon, right? And that's part of the reason why they capture Constantinople. A lot of historians actually don't think that the use of cannons against Constantinople was such a big deal. That it was just like the fact that they had way more soldiers.
Constantinople being modern day Istanbul, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
And then by the time it gets to Europe, right, what happens is that they not only have the cannon and refine the cannon, but they also start competing between nations. And that's why Europe was such a hotbed of innovation, was because there was so much competition.
Not only that, but a great deal of, you know, the kings, there was something called alchemy, which is this idea of let's create gold. Let's mm-hmm. try to make gold right. in a laboratory, which actually led to a whole bunch of chemical innovations.
That's right. You know? And a bad theory, that's the thing. Like, even though alchemy was total, you know, yeah. junk, it actually led to a lot of the building blocks of chemistry.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That's right.
Absolutely.
There was a point that you had gotten to that I wanted to kind of touch on. But still, there is this fundamental difference and a huge difference between human beings and animals. You know, and I think it was William James who said, you know, Darwin said, well, we were monkeys. We started as protozoa and then became these pointy-tailed hominids. But he said, yes, it may be true that we are protozoa and became monkeys, but there was something about that monkey that inspired it to Greek. You know, this is the right. reason that we have Shakespeare and Aeschylus and Sophocles and, mm-hmm. and et cetera, et cetera. You know, that really is what raises questions to me. That's a huge jump, man.
Well, but see, that's part of the reason.
And what's the point? Is it all math? Is it all just a process of evolution? To what end? I mean, what are we being nudged toward? I think ourselves. I think as we're being nudged into sort of a collective consciousness. Mm-hmm. And then you ask the question of why. You know, if you read, you know, look at Ray Kurzweil, who talks about when you can download the essence of who you are, your memories and your thoughts into a computer or a robot, mm-hmm. do you ever die? And then what is the point of that? Why are we doing this? We are meshing with machines. Immortality is actually a reality, if you think about it. It's a different thing than we're thinking about. But our biology, these machines are going to be relics, mm-hmm. the way your old cell phone is.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, Juan Enriquez calls it homo evolutus. You know, we're going to evolve into these synthetic biological machines that are incredibly efficient. And you mm-hmm. know, but my question is always: it really does seem that history is moving.
Is directional.
History yeah. is directional. It is not chaotic.
Mm-mm.
It's not just an accident of math. It's not just Darwinian. There's something else at work here.
And essentially, like, that's a large part of what the breakdown of the last 150 years has been about. Is that, you know, there was this very strong idea in, you know, in the 17 and the 1800s with the Enlightenment that progress was possible, that humanity could raise itself up, it could do better. That's what the scientific revolution was all about. Mm. And then essentially we lost faith in that. And that's really what
That's interesting.
Yeah.
We lost faith. When did we lose faith, do you think?
Well, I mean, there's actually, you know, different people have different pieces, but essentially, yeah, we start to lose faith, I would say, in the late 1800s. And it's really because...
But there was a renaissance in the 1800s, a mathematical one, wasn't there, in Scotland?
There were always, and there's always progress going on. It's yeah. not that the thing stops, right? It's just the question is, like, nobody doubts that the Renaissance was an uptick, right?
And it's true, and I think we live in this article that by Christine Wampole, and you guys should all read it, called How to Live Without Irony. It was in last Sunday's Times, New York Times, I think. And, you know, she basically said this hipster movement, this ironic living, she calls it, is a group of people who really don't believe they have anything to offer culturally. Mm-hmm. They have nothing to offer to their culture, and they have nothing to offer in even ideas, because their ideas, this cynical notion that my idea is just going to be consumed by a better idea. So what's the point yeah. of thinking? I'll just try to be unique by piercing my nose and getting tattoos, as opposed to wrestling within the problem of individuality with concepts and ideas and accomplishments.
And that's the ultimate outcome of moral relativism.
Oh, that's interesting.
If all ideas are equally good,
yeah.
right, then why strive for anything?
I can't stand moral relativism. I can't stand relativism. You know, and we all fall into that trap. But you know, you're right. If you want to solve the problems of the world... And there are problems out there.
Yeah.
From global warming to, you know, inequalities and things. If you want to solve those problems, the truth of the matter is you have got to fight for what you believe is your truth.
That's right.
And you can be a relativist and you can try to be a politician and get along with everybody. And I want to talk to you about, because you said some really interesting things about politicians recently, but in the end, and it goes to what you think are this renaissance is, which is What is it? Moral. It is. You were talking about the next step is intellectual.
Intellectual inclusivity.
Intellectual inclusivity. The notion that we have to get out there. The concept that you can do anything you want.
That's right.
It's a question of managing your emotions around what you're trying to learn. Right. And that's a really is where science is. There's a lot of books, not just your book, mm-hmm. The Straight A Conspiracy, which I recommend to everybody, and we'll put it on the website. But there are a lot of books that are about this. Science is, you said that there are 300 genes that can point to mental retardation. They've not yet isolated one gene that can point toward intelligence.
Normal or above average intelligence.
Normal or above average intelligence.
Yeah.
That's amazing to me.
Yeah.
So it's really a question of how you use this computer
called
the brain.
Absolutely. And that's the thing is that you look at how did the founding fathers use the computers they had. Like, these people are not wildly genetically different from us. Like, 200-300 years, changes don't happen over that sort of time span that are that significant, right? Or think about, like, I think the clearest example is language learning, right? We are, in the United States, we are all descended from people who spoke 3-4 languages fairly routinely, right? And that was standard, and it wasn't because they had Rosetta Stone, and it wasn't because they went to the Berlitz School.
They needed it.
It's because they needed it.
Yeah.
And the point is that now, you know, amazingly, like, everyone in America seems to not have a natural ear for languages, right? What a crock.
It's a crock.
Yeah.
You said something interesting about leaders and today's leaders and, you know, whether it's Barack Obama or Mitt Romney and our political system as it stands now. And I want to talk about that because you said something really interesting. You said it no longer becomes about leaders. Great leaders are selling a belief. They're selling a why. They're selling something that they truly believe, and that's something that other people can latch onto, and they can feel like they believe. But instead, what we're doing is we're basically watching elections between two of the best fundraisers.
Right. And Lawrence Lessig, who is a Harvard Law School professor, he wrote this book called Republic Lost, which is about what has happened to America.
By the way, Hunter reads a lot. Republic Lost.
And I also listen to a lot of audiobooks. Thank you, audible.com.
Thank you, audible.com. Yep.
But Lessig tells this story. He said when Lessig was considering a run for Congress in California in 2008, the famed political strategist Joe Trippi agreed to run his campaign on one condition. He said, "You've got to promise me one thing, that you will get on the telephone for 2 to 4 hours every single day between now and the day you decide you no longer want to be in government and call people you've never met to ask them for money."
God, that's what it takes to get elected.
Yeah, 2 to 4 hours every day asking people you've never met for money.
Jesus.
And so the point is that, you know, when money is such an important part of getting elected as a Republican or as a Democrat, right, what happens is that you have to become a fundraiser, right? And
And you've got to be best friends with real fundraisers.
That's right.
So fundraisers in this political climate are the ones with the real power.
And fundraisers fundamentally have to be people that everybody like. And the best way to make sure that everybody likes you is to say nothing, basically, right? Because if you say something and have a strong opinion, you're going to piss someone off.
It's what bothered me about Mitt Romney. I mean, Mitt Romney is, I think, probably a good man. I think he's a very accomplished governor. Mm-hmm. He was an accomplished businessman. But I would hear this guy talk, and I was just like, "You are a fucking politician right now, man." You know, I don't want to hear you tell me that you believe Jesus Christ is that. I'm not interested in your personal beliefs. I want to keep religion out of politics. I want to just hear what you're going to do to solve these problems, and I want to hear a philosophy.
That's right.
You know, that you believe in, for That's better right. or for worse.
And the thing is that, you know, essentially what happens is that on both sides of the political equation, because we need the Republicans and we need the Democrats.
Yeah, you need vigorous debate.
Absolutely.
You need the left and the right, and you need them to come together. You need not come together. There's something great that happens when two sides that are intelligent argue for a
That's
point
right.
of view. I'm right-wing guy in a lot of ways. I mean, I'm definitely not a left-wing. I'm very socially liberal. Mm-hmm. I just am. That's why I couldn't vote for Mitt Romney, because I just can't look at my gay friends and say, "I don't think you have a right to marry." I can't do that. I just don't believe in that. And I also I respect the right to life. I respect mm-hmm. the pro-life people, because they believe that abortion is murder. I respect that. I understand if that's your moral religious point of view. But the problem is, I also respect a woman's right to do with her body what she chooses. I think that actually takes precedence, and it may be heresy to a lot of people. I just think that that's more important, and I also think that a woman knows whether or not she can take care of a child. There are a lot of children that wouldn't have been taken care of. You know, people who are pro-life, I respect their point of view, but are you going to take care of that child?
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of children that are neglected.
Some of them will. I mean,
sure they will, and again, these are good people. I mean, there's this idea, my God, that you hear in Hollywood, well, they're Republican, so they're bad. Shut up. They're not bad people. You know, that's ridiculous. They just have a different philosophy that doesn't gel with yours. You have to respect. Well, but
it's also look at the two issues that you've cited, right?
Yeah.
Gay marriage and abortion,
yeah.
Right? And these are important issues for any society to decide. But look at the amount of time that was spent discussing those two issues.
Yeah, it drives me crazy.
Look at the amount of time that was spent discussing education, that was discussing like...
Those are the real issues.
That's right.
They are the real issues. You know, they're very important issues. That's exactly right. You've got to look at what is the best way to fix this economy. That means what is the best way to give people a better life and more opportunity. And going back to what you said, which is great, this idea of inclusivity. How do we tackle those issues? That's how you reform education.
That's right.
You know, yet we're spending all this time in gays in the military.
That's right.
You know, when Clinton brought that up, who gives a fuck?
Well, but
I get it. I mean, I get the need for a vocal minority and, you know, just any minority to have a say and feel included. I'm all about that. You know, it's why as a comic, I've never made fun of gay people. I don't think it's funny. I don't think it's funny. I don't think that, you know, there are gay people that come to my show that are there to have a good time, and I'm gonna make fun of them.
Yeah.
Oh, really? I don't think it's. I just don't think it's funny. It's not even that I'm a nice guy. I just don't think it's funny. It makes me feel bad. But anyway.
But you know, and this is part of the point that Lessig makes in his book is that, you know, there is a reason why the political conversation has become dominated by those hot button issues. Right? By issues that are, you know, social issues that are divisive, like gay marriage and like abortion.
Mm.
And it's because that's what gets people to give money. Like if I'm, you know, whether
vocal minorities.
The vocal minorities who get terrified that their way of life is under threat, whatever that way of life is, and therefore they're rushing to the phones and giving money.
Oh wow, okay. Well, that's interesting. And so your panacea for that would be to take money out of politics altogether.
Well, I think firstly you have to make people aware that that is the problem, and that, you know, because I think, you know, most Americans, we do love our country and we want to believe that the system is working well. And so therefore we really do try and get legitimately excited about one of these two candidates. And I think we have to acknowledge that the candidates that Mitt Romney and Barack Obama could be, they didn't hit that mark.
That's true. You said something really interesting when Kennedy and Nixon debated. Those that watched them on TV thought Kennedy won because he was just a better looking, brighter guy.
Yeah.
Just physically brighter. And those that listened to Nixon and Kennedy on the radio thought Nixon won.
Yep.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I think radio is way better than TV for that, for presidential debates. We wouldn't be looking at their faces.
That's
and,
right.
And, God damn it, with that fucking Mitt Romney and making that angelic choir boy face just smiling away. I don't want to look at the face. I want to hear what they're saying. I want to hear their voices.
And, you know, I mean, that's the thing is Nixon also famously during that 1960 presidential debate had the biggest flop sweat of all time.
Did he?
Yeah, because he basically, like, they got his makeup wrong, so he looked really weird, and then he just started sweating profusely.
Oh, God, and poor Nixon.
Yeah.
He had such a strange-looking body and
absolutely.
Face. Yeah.
But the thing is that that's it should be about his ideas. It should not be about, like, you know, does he look good on camera? Like, who the hell gives
a crap? Of course not.
Yeah.
Of course it shouldn't. And by the way, I don't even think it should have to do with what his sexual... you know, proclivities are. I mean, you know, if he fucks around or not, I don't give a shit, man. I just want the best statesman.
That's right.
I do. I know that there's a moral high ground and a standard, and I respect it. But that it doesn't trump intelligence and a guy who's trying to do the right thing. He may be a fuck up in some parts of his life, but what he does in his bedroom means fucking shit to me. I just want to know that he's got a good political and economic philosophy that I can sink my teeth into, and that I can moor into, and that I can leapfrog from.
Well, and that's the thing is that most of us have a really hard time sinking our teeth into those political economic philosophies, and that's partly because, you know, they're not speaking, you know, straight up. They're not like saying what's really going on with them. But I think the other thing that we really have to look at as citizens is our failures. Like, how much do we understand about government, and how much do we understand, and I'm saying about government, not about politics, because the two are very, very different, right? The founding fathers read a lot of history. They were obsessed with history because they thought that history was essentially humanity's lab, right? You try it out. If you look across history, you can find out that almost every experiment has been done. And then you can look at those experiments and see what worked, what didn't work, why didn't it work, and all that stuff. And that's how they were able to write the Constitution, is because they really understood how should a government be structured. We have all grown up in a government that works.
Yeah.
And so we therefore have never really taken the time, I think most of us, to try and understand how does a government work.
Well, because the thing about living in the United States and having enough to eat, etc., and not having to worry about an oppressive government, is that you have the luxury of avoiding political commitment.
That's right.
And most people throughout history, including in the founding of this country, did not have that luxury. You had to be politically committed. I would certainly, you know, your the wrong ideas in World War II and especially in World War I and afterwards. The wrong ideas won out in big swaths of the world, which led to half the world's population practically living as essentially slaves, in my
opinion.
Worse
than slaves. I mean, you look at what happened in the Cultural Revolution.
Well, that was the worst in China. People talk about Mao Zedong. Nobody ever talks about Mao Zedong. That guy was a mass murderer.
Right.
He was a mass murderer on a scale that Stalin and Hitler were, for that matter. And, it's amazing to me. You see kids with Mao Zedong T-shirts. They should pick up a history book. That guy was a fucking monster and a bad person and a sociopath and should be lumped together with Stalin and Hitler. And Hitler has a different place in the sense that he was such a racist, you know.
But Stalin, like, yeah. Stalin, you know, Hitler and Stalin people don't equate them. And, you know, yeah, there is a difference in the sense that Hitler actively went about mass murder. But the number of people that Stalin killed, both through mismanagement and through political purges.
He starved the Ukraine. Man.
That's right.
He starved the Ukraine in the 30s. And they think probably between 10 and 20 million died of starvation. So, and he did it deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
So the wrong ideas can get you killed. The wrong ideas can do worse than get you killed. They can erase and eradicate everything that you hold dear and everything else. So if you think you can avoid political commitment, you're sadly mistaken.
Well,
you can for a while, but not forever.
And that's why, you know, I mean, the Second Amendment, right? A well-regulated militia being necessary to, like, defending, like, whatever the exact words are.
The right to bear arms.
Right. But essentially, yes, it is absolutely. But that's number two.
Mm-hmm.
Number one is the First Amendment.
Mm.
And that's about freedom of the press, freedom of speech. That's about the exchange of ideas, right? And, you know, just as you can be excluded from exchanging ideas by, you know, the press being regulated or censored or anything like that, you can also be self-excluded from ideas. And that's essentially what these beliefs about of intelligence
The First Amendment is always under threat.
Mm-hmm.
We live in a society now that exists that way. As a stand-up comic, it's the last bastion of free speech. I can say whatever the fuck I want.
Well, that's not entirely true.
That's true. There is a tyranny. There is a tyranny of language. And there's a tyranny of the majority in a politically correct majority here. And I don't think it's good. This is not a new idea, but the First Amendment is constantly under attack. Censorship is, it seems to me, a human compulsion. And Ray Bradbury's book, Fahrenheit 451, is, you know, it was written in the 50s, and it is so relevant today.
And what 1984.
Orwell's 1984 is.
I mean, I reread that recently, and that's the thing.
That's a scary book.
I
read that in high school, and I never forgot it.
But the thing is that when you get right down to it, the final battlefield is the mind. Like, that is always where freedom is won or lost.
That's what totalitarianism was about. Totalitarianism is control over the total person.
That's
what
right.
They think. Face crime. Remember 1984? Yeah. If you haven't read 1984, you are remiss, everyone.
You're missing out.
It's a very, very important book to read. You're missing out, and it's a seminal book. It's a seminal book, and I want to talk to you about if you had to take a young person, have them read 10 books. I want you to give me a list, because I think you have one. But 1984's got to be in it. It's a seminal book. You know, when they talk about face crime, I used to be in a class, an acting class with Scientologists, and I know a lot of them, and so I can talk freely. And I don't have anything against Scientologists in general, but one of my teachers used to look at people and go, "What's going on with your face? You got to check your face over here." And there was face crime in my fucking class. And I used to be like, "Listen, motherfucker, if anybody's, nobody ever said that shit to me. Yeah. I never got, nobody's going to say shit to me because I would have, it would have been a physical fight probably."
Mm-hmm.
Because I would have been like, you read 1984 and then talk to me about my face and shut the fuck up before I take you outside and beat the shit out of you. Read that book. It's very important. Give me 10 books. If you're a kid, you have to read.
I would actually say Why Nations Fail is certainly one of them. 1984 is one of them. I would say Guns, Germs, and Steel.
That's a great
absolutely
book. I agree.
I would say The Next 100 Years. It's by George Friedman.
Yep, heard it.
It's a superb book.
Really?
I would also say A Splendid Exchange, which is a really, really great book. It's about world trade. But I think that's the thing is that so often we hear, you know, that about capitalism. But that book, just by showing how does capitalism improve the standard of living for everybody, it really does a great job. Because it's like, if you think about it, think about if we were in the year 1500, right? So we're living in, you know, the reign of Henry VIII. And we're like, look at all these poor people. How are we going to help all these poor people? Well, the answer that we would probably come up with is to say charity. Like, you know, you should give more money from the king to these people and then
that's
their
right.
lives will be better.
That's right.
But essentially,
the answer is inspiration, by the way. But,
yeah, the answer is inspiration, yeah. Which is essentially capitalism.
Yeah.
Which is that as people compete,
let people come up with their own ideas,
that's right.
and take the barriers away from letting them exchange ideas, exchange
mm-hmm.
goods,
mm-hmm.
and make their own decisions. Because they know what's best for them, you don't.
That's right. And also, I mean, that's what, you know, you get rich by finding something that's done poorly and doing it better.
Mm.
It's about finding inefficiency.
Say that again. That's
you
really
get
good.
Rich by finding things that are done poorly and doing them better. And that's the brilliant thing about capitalism is that essentially people compete. They're looking for, like, what's done poorly because that's where I make money. And in the process, you end up with 500 years later, where now, you know, the standard of living for the average person is incredibly high,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, it's so much higher than it was in the 1500s. And
it's so much higher than it was in the
1700s. Yeah. And no charity was required.
Yeah.
Right? Charity helps, and charity can, you know, it's the old thing of give a man a fish, you'll feed him for a day. Yep. Teach a man to fish, he'll feed himself for a lifetime.
That's right.
And that's the thing is that what the world needs is for people to be allowed to feed
that's
themselves.
That's my problem with the left-wing thought process. It you know, that's my problem with Obama. I mean, you know, extending unemployment insurance and basically, which is a fucking way of saying, hey, big labor, here's more money.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I talked to Arnold Schwarzenegger, said that his problem with Obama was that he didn't put money into infrastructure. He sprinkled that money into the labor unions. Well, we'll give you more unemployment insurance for a long period of time, more charity. Bullshit. It doesn't help anybody. It keeps them, you know, alive a little longer. But
the thing that has to be understood is that, like, you know, on the surface, if you look at some of these South American countries, they're capitalist on the surface.
Mm.
But in practice, because there's not real competition, right, that capitalism becomes destructive, right?
That's
they're destroying
right.
wealth,
mm-hmm.
right? And so essentially,
in other words, six people make all the money.
That's right. And the rest of them are
becomes an oligarchy.
That's right. And so the thing is that the difference between, you know, constructive competition, right, and basically constructive inequality where people are competing, right, but not everybody has the same amount, but there's equality of opportunity and destructive inequality, which is what you have in places like South America or North Korea or any of these sorts of places. And that's what the Democrats and the Republicans are trying to argue about, but the argument is not clear, right? Mm-hmm. It seems like they're arguing about capitalism or not capitalism, but that's not really what they're arguing about. And that's the thing is that essentially, you know, a well-informed public is necessary to keeping the government in check.
Well, you know, you can't do that when you got to catch all the Kardashian episodes.
Well,
it's very difficult.
That's the point.
It's very difficult.
Right.
Or Jersey Shore. There's nothing wrong with entertainment. I just think entertainment should inspire. and most of our entertainment doesn't.
No, and it doesn't challenge us, and I think that's ultimately in terms of if you just pander to me, you don't really respect
and,
me.
And challenging us is another way of saying asking us questions we have to wrestle with.
That's right.
That's when I watch a great movie, or I'm watching Breaking Bad now, which is the best show I've seen on TV since The Sopranos, probably. And, you know, it really raises questions. If mm-hmm. I were in this position, how would I behave? It does such a great job.
Or The Wire.
The Wire is the best show of all time.
It's
me,
amazing.
Of all time. But these are, you know, that's why as a human being, you know, if I were a self-help guru, I would look at people and say, you got to learn how to ask yourself the right questions every day.
Yeah.
Because that's how you find the answers.
That's right.
You know, I think Tony Robbins actually says that. You know, ask yourself the right
questions.
Tony
Robbins can't claim credit for that. That's being said by thinkers
of course,
throughout
of
history.
Of course. That's right. That's exactly right. So keep going with your books. Because then I want to ask you the books that changed your life as a young man.
These are basically the books that changed my life.
Really?
Yeah. I mean,
But these are recent books you've read. So
a lot of them, yeah.
There was a lot of stuff that you came up with and you may not remember, though.
Well, but I mean, that's for example, I mean, I know when I read Guns, Germs, and Steel.
Yeah.
That was like such a weight off of me because because essentially the problem is that what Guns, Germs, and Steel
he probably got you started on the notion. I mean, he actually talks about biology having nothing
absolutely.
To do with intelligence or, you know, why did Sub-Saharan Africa not be as developed as, you know, Northern Europe? There's mm-hmm. very, very clear reasons for that. We just got lucky.
Well, and why nations fail, they actually don't necessarily totally agree with Guns, Germs, and Steel,
right?
But there's essentially, I think the answer really comes from mixing those two books. I don't think it's like, I don't think either of them have a monopoly on the truth.
to interrupt you because you said it lifted a weight off your, what was the weight?
Well, essentially you look at, if you're someone who lives in the West, if you live in America and you look at a place like Africa, right? How are you supposed to make sense of that?
Mm-hmm.
And essentially there are two ways to think of that are currently out there. One is, we have just been so shitty to these people and abused them so much, which is essentially what liberals say, right? That, you know, they've never had a chance. We oppressed them with colonialism and we've just kept on screwing them and screwing them and screwing them. And that obviously feels terrible. And the other alternative is to say that essentially, let's be honest, Africans just aren't that smart,
mm-hmm.
right? And, you know, that is also terrible, right?
Yeah.
But in the absence of any real understanding of how things work,
you are left with those two options.
You're left with those two options.
Yeah, and that's right. And it did such a. I think a lot of Black Americans even wrestled with that. You know,
I think it's incredibly difficult.
There was somebody said that they've done a lot of studies with Black Americans, and a lot of Black men didn't think they were even as capable as white men because they were looking at their history in Sub-Saharan Africa, mm-hmm. not lost on them, when they should have been looking at a book like Guns, Germs, and Steel. A guy who worked with a lot of the indigenous tribes of Papua New Guinea and stuff, who said it has nothing to do with that. It has to do with an accident of geography,
mm-hmm.
an accident of, you know, there are no animals in Sub-Saharan Africa that you can domesticate. It's very hard to plant things. It's very hard to, you know, and it talks about how lucky, you know, if you lived in the Fertile Crescent, how
absolutely.
Lucky you were to have grasses like barley and millet and things that were nutritious, or in China, things like rice.
Right. Until the Fertile Crescent undergoes an ecological disaster. Because that's the other thing, too, is I remember when I was reading history textbooks as a kid, you hear about the Fertile Crescent and you're like, I'm pretty sure that's the Middle East, and I'm pretty sure that's all desert, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is that now it is all desert,
that's
but 10,000 years ago, it certainly wasn't. But, you know, you read Guns, Germs, and Steel, and you begin to understand, like, oh, the difference is not the people, right? The difference is the forces of history, and it's ordinary people in different situations reacting as those people would.
That's
and that's the point that, you know, that in Why Nations Fail, they make the same point, which is essentially like, listen, any idea that the difference is people is ridiculous once you look at North and South Korea. Because these are people who are as close as being the same people as you can get.
Yeah.
They're divided by only 50 years of history.
Yeah.
And their climate is pretty much the same.
Yeah.
So the difference is the political systems.
That's right.
You know, and it's fascinating.
Incentive structures.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you know, people, we wouldn't say, like, we look at the Soviet Union, they had huge problems with truancy. People wouldn't show up to work. People wouldn't work hard, you know, and the old joke in the Soviet Union was, we'll pretend to work as long as they pretend to pay us.
Fucking great.
But the, you know, it's not like the Russian people weren't inherently lazy. It wasn't anything about them. It was just a function of the political system that they were under.
Right.
You know, and that's the thing is that if you really don't think that you're going to be able to keep your hard work, you're not going to work hard.
Yeah.
Because you get the same no matter what.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that's what's a lot of these books that, you know, the first five books that I've mentioned, these are the books that essentially started to really give me the idea that, you know, it's the difference is not who we are. It's our circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look at those lessons and we really analyze them and we really understand them, then we can create circumstances that allow everybody to fulfill their potential. And not just in, you know, the United States or not just in parts of the United States, but in the entire world.
That is your religion.
That is. I mean, yeah. That's what I believe. And that's if...
And that's what your book, The Straight A Conspiracy, is about. And that's... it's a beautiful thing to, you know, to... because it's more than hope. It's the science is on your side.
That's right.
The more and more we learn about humanity and stuff, is it's really true. There is no difference. We all have the same potential.
And if you want to talk about evolution, right? You know, the amount of time that Homo sapiens has been around for is tiny.
It's infinitesimal.
It's so small.
I remember thinking about this when I read Malcolm X's biography. I think it was by Any Means Necessary or something. And I loved it because when I was in college or something, he said, look at where, like take black people. Where black people have been allowed to compete and excel is in music and sports.
Mm-hmm.
Look what they've done.
Mm-hmm.
Look what they've done there. And now more and more, the idea that the imagination, we need more black minds that are moving into science and business
we need
and stuff
more
with
minds
the same
moving,
idea.
And it's the same
more
thing.
More minds, generally.
Yeah.
And then black is, there's no difference. It's like
that's
saying
right.
black minds versus
that's
white
right.
minds. It's all the same mind.
And the point is that, you know, it also does not serve
we're
us.
So politically correct on this podcast. But we're not politically correct. We're actually, this is the truth.
Yeah, and what we're saying is that it would be, imagine, like, you know, Einstein, when he couldn't solve a physics problem, he would go play the violin.
Yeah, that's I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't even know he could play the violin.
But that's the point, is that the human mind is not supposed to be limited. The human mind is supposed to be able to, like, be playing with all these things. And that's why you have those Renaissance figures like Da Vinci, who does everything,
yeah.
and Franklin, who does everything. And that's what the human mind wants to do. That's what we want to do. We want to learn everything.
Mm.
And the problem is that we've been so, you know, compartmentalized and broken down. And that's really, like, this is what I think this moment in history is about the reunification of the human mind, the heart, the body, all of these sorts of things. And, you know, in the Joseph Campbell, right, who's the big guru of storytelling.
I've read everything he's ever written.
That's right. And he's incredible. But the goal of any story, what the hero achieves at the end of any story, is he becomes the universal man. And we are entering the age of the universal man, which is someone who is not only physically fit and, you know, strong and, you know, comes with their full heart and, you know, has interest in everything and is, you know, masters musical instruments and languages and sciences and all of this stuff. That's the moment that we're at.
That's a beautiful way of looking at things.
Campbell
spent 5 years in a room, not only reading everybody who all the leaders have thought in all their books, but reading all the people that influenced them.
Mm-hmm.
So he'd take an author like Joseph Conrad and not only read all his books, but then read all the books that Conrad had read.
And read all the myths of the world from single culture and compared them. Yeah,
Joseph Campbell, for me, you know, had probably was the most one of the most influential thinkers. I mean,
mm-hmm.
just as a young man changing my mind and developing my mind and developing my philosophies, Joseph Campbell was a giant, you know. What would you say for...
And I would put, by the way, I would say that is one of my books, The Hero with a Thousand Faces.
Great.
It's definitely one of mine.
Would you say, as a... You're a highly educated guy. With somebody, I get a lot of young men who say, how do I educate myself? What do I read? Can you give them a syllabus in 50 words or less?
Yeah, I would say it's really simple. Read everything.
But when you say read everything, you know, you got Pat Conroy, and then you got Socrates. I mean, so
oh, well, read the greats, because the point is that
so let's start with philosophy.
If you're gonna. Well, I would actually say for that, there's a book called Man's Search for Meaning.
Great book.
Which is an amazing book, and I would also put that
David
on that
Blaine,
list.
David Blaine, the magician.
Oh, really?
Let me read that book, yes.
It's one of my favorite books of all time, and yeah. It's...
Viktor Frankl, I think.
Viktor Frankl, that's right. And Viktor Frankl, I mean, it's a great story. He
was in Auschwitz, and...
He was sent to one of the concentration camps, I can't remember.
I think it wasn't Auschwitz, but I remember he lost his wife, and his... When he found out he lost his wife, and he was going to throw himself on the electric fence, and then kind of said, if I can suffer through this with dignity...
Well, yeah, so he and his wife had really, like, put all of their collective efforts into his writing of this book. Mm. And, you know, so when he is, you know, herded towards the concentration camp, the one thing he is sure to bring is the manuscript of his book.
That's right, yeah.
And he turns up to the room where they're, like, taking off the watches and the coats and the shoes and all that sort of stuff. And, of course, the Nazis have... They're like, you want to keep your manuscript for your
they're
book?
They're Nazis.
Yeah, they're Nazis.
And they're Nazis about making sure you don't have anything on you.
That's right. So, the you know, this thing that is his life work is gone. It's lost. And basically, as he goes through the concentration camp, you know, he gets typhus, he suffers through all of these diseases, and, you know, he tells a story about how one night, as he's basically, he knows that, as because he has medical training, if he falls asleep, he dies. Mm. He's that sick. And so he keeps himself conscious by trying to reconstruct the book on scraps of paper.
Yeah.
And what this basically taught him is he said the people who survived Auschwitz were the people who had purpose.
Yeah.
And that's why I survived.
He also said the best of us didn't survive. You mm-hmm. know, I mean, a lot of times you couldn't be your higher self. You
right.
had to be a fucking, you had to be a rat. Almost.
That's right.
You had to figure out any by any means necessary how to survive.
Well, and that really.
But he said there's dignity in suffering too. There is if you learn how to suffer with dignity, that's mm-hmm. a great accomplishment.
Well, and that's the thing is that, you know, if you're in a situation like Auschwitz, yes, you know, it's hard to keep your higher self. And in the same way, if you're living in a place like Central Africa or you're living in some of these countries in the Middle East, it's hard to keep your dignity.
Did the Angels with Dirty Faces, Jimmy Cagney, you ever see that movie?
Oh, yeah.
And he goes to the electric chair and he's going to go like a man. Like, you know, I'm going to die like a man. I'm not going to. And his buddy, who's a priest, came mm-hmm. to him, played by the great actor, I can't remember his name. And Fred McMurray.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to him and said, I want you to go to the chair yellow. I want you to go to the chair crying and begging them not to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
He said, are you kidding me? All I got is my balls before I go to the electric chair. I'm not going to, my reputation. He said, that's what I want you to destroy. I don't want these kids to look up to you.
Uh-huh.
I want these kids to realize at the end you were a coward because you're a hero, but for the wrong reason.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, he goes, get out of here. I'm not doing it. In the end, he goes to the electric chair and you see his shadow as he's, please don't kill me. I don't want to die.
Yeah.
And he fakes being a coward.
Coward, yeah.
And,
that's amazing.
And it's a great, great ending, you know. I hope that tied into what you were saying.
but it's the same thing. Yeah. I mean, it's really hard in those sort of circumstances to keep your dignity.
Yeah.
And that's ultimately, I mean, that's what so much of this is about, is it's about dignity, right? That's what we want. We want to be appreciated and we want to have dignity.
Dignity, the ability to have your own, enjoy your own sovereignty,
mm-hmm.
you know?
And that's the thing is, you know, I think so much of it, because this was once called Man Thoughts, right? Just a short hour ago.
This is the Brian
ago.
Callen Show, ladies and gentlemen. Just a reminder. God, are we intelligent? I'm about to lose battery here, man. We better end this, but you have been awesome, and we're at a minute. Oh, we're at an hour 15 minutes, dude. Time flies. Hunter Motz, you are a gem. There needs to be more of you, and I appreciate you talking on the Man Thoughts / Brian Callen Show. And thanks for tuning in. But check my website, briancallen.com. I'll be coming to San Francisco in January, Vancouver in January, and I got a lot of dates. God bless.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show. Be sure to visit briancallen.com for information about this episode as well as past and future episodes. You can follow Brian on Twitter at Brian Callen and like him on Facebook. Go to facebook.com/Brian Callen Comedy. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time.